Okay, good afternoon. This is the LaRouche Show. My name is Paul Gallagher. I'll be the host today on today's show, a guest of Marsha Baker, our usual host. And our topic, while you're listening to this program today, imbeciles are meeting with the White House on how to destroy the world. That's, of course, referring to the economic summit. Emergency Economic Summit of 20 heads of state, which right at this hour is apparently already over. And these people were supposed to be meeting to do something about the breakdown crisis of the world economy. It seems that they were showed themselves completely unable to in any way interfere with the suicide of the banks, these suicide bombers of banks, which keep exploding, and have probably taken no measures of any significance at that meeting. But we'll get to that. Nonetheless, in spite of what this looks like, the reality was present at this meeting, like a wind blowing through the room, blowing the papers off the desks. The LaRouche factor was present at this meeting in the sense of reality blowing through the room, and we're going to be discussing the direction in which that reality is going to be pushing these nations and these heads of state in the immediate days and weeks ahead. So that's our subject. We'll be discussing that during the next hour with John Hopeful, the head of economics for the Lyndon LaRouche Political Action Committee, and Miles Robinson, who's with us from on the phone from Boston, from the LaRouche Youth Movement organizing chapter in Boston, which does quite a bit of good organizing, and Farida Gillisberg from Copenhagen, although she's here in the studio now. So a number of things that are sane are happening in Denmark, and Farida represents them. She is a leader of the LaRouche movement in Denmark, a vice president of the Schiller Institute there, and a friend and longtime collaborator of Helga LaRouche. So what we'll do is lay out some of the basics of the potential importance of this meeting today and what happened to derail it. And we'll do that through some questions that we'll direct to those among us, and then maybe we can just have a general discussion of it. I think most importantly, let's start with the basic question. I'd like to direct it to John Hopeful. What was the potential for this summit meeting of the so-called G8? What should G20? Sorry, what should it have done? What was the potential here?
What it should have done was to start off with an admission that the global monetary system, this Anglo-Dutch liberal monetary system, has died. And then go work for a replacement, and to replace that system not with another monetary system of the same type, but to replace it with something that would actually work, which is a U.S. style credit system, an American system style credit system, in which the you don't have a world run by central banks. You have a world run by a government and sovereign governments issuing credit and using that, directing that credit to go to development projects which raise the standard of living of all mankind. So what you really needed to do with this thing is to admit, start off with the just the stark admission, the system is gone, it has to be replaced, this whole model has failed, so we're going to go with something that we know historically does work. And so it needed to be replaced, and that's the most, if they would just announce that, then the rest of the details could be worked out. You know, what they, and the other thing, I mean, if they really were serious, the thing to do is that when the meeting starts, they tell the British to sit down and shut up, and then they turn the meeting over to Lyndon LaRouche so he can tell them what actually has to be done.
Okay, what's the importance of shutting the British out or shutting them up,
well,
at a minimum?
Yeah.
Gordon Brown here.
Well, Gordon Brown is pushing a British imperial strategy of a global financial dictatorship. They want to use this crisis to institute global corporatist fascism, to turn institutions like the IMF into what Henry Paulson wants to be in the United States, and to control the finances of nations, to run the derivatives markets and things like that, to use the manipulation of money to control national economies as a way of smashing nations. And the real goal of what they plan to do is to eliminate the role of the nation state as a political force in human affairs.
A lot of the country's heads of states have been throwing around the term New Bretton Woods or Bretton Woods II, at least up until the recent days. They were in the British press and around the British government. They've been talking about John Maynard Keynes. What's the actual steps, after an announcement, the actual steps most important for these nations to take, and what does Keynes have to do with it?
Well, Keynes was the British representative at the Bretton Woods Conference, and it was Keynes who was pushing the British system over the American system as advocated by FDR. So that the battle and we had the power. FDR had the power, so the American system won. And what the British are now trying to do is to revisit Bretton Woods, only this time they want the Keynesian approach to win. Now, what needs to be done is that the first thing that has to happen is that you have to admit that the system is bankrupt, and then you have to put the global financial system through bankruptcy. This would be done by nation states, in which you would take actions to write off, just eliminate the derivatives, write off unpayable debts, freeze them with the idea that they would be written off as you could work through them to sort out what's good and what's bad, and then take steps to protect the welfare of the population while you do so, to make sure that you keep the keep people in their homes, keep the food flowing to the grocery stores, keep the lights on, you know, that sort of thing, and make sure that that no one starves to death if their pensions are tied up in this freeze. And then from that, then you adopt a two-tiered credit system in which you have directed credit for infrastructure projects. And this would be, you know, you'd have to do this on a worldwide basis, because you can't just save one nation or a handful of nations. You basically have to restart the productive capacity of the entire world in order to lift the human population out of this dark age that we've been falling into. So you have directed credit, great projects, science driver projects, in which then you push back the boundaries of science. You know, you educate your people, you make technological breakthroughs, scientific breakthroughs, you implement those in technology. You go to things like magnetic levitation trains, nuclear power, you know, a whole gamut of new technologies. And then you have an agreement among the leading nations of the world, led by Russia, China, and India, because those with the United States are the nations which represent the bulk of the world's population. And if those nations stick together, then they have the political power to push this thing through over the British objections. And if you do all of, if you do those things, then you turn the world around. If you don't do those things, we're not going to make it.
Now, on that specifically, the great projects that would come out of a real New Bretton Woods, I want to bring Farida Gillesberg from Denmark into the discussion, because this has really characterized the highlights of and the breakthroughs of their organizing there. And also, maybe you can talk about some of the European countries, although they may not be the key countries in actually setting up a new system, have been talking about the Roosevelt New Bretton Woods before this conference. And part of that was, of course, the World Bank and the development of infrastructure in Europe. And what, as John's indicating, what we're now talking about with a New Bretton Woods is the development of great projects of infrastructure among countries worldwide. And this is, I think, directly what you've been organizing on in Denmark.
Yeah, but because what I can say about the question of the Transrapid, no, actually the Maglev train in Denmark for around 2 years, and 2 years when we had the parliamentary election, we were running for parliament. Tom was running for the head of the Schiller Institute in Denmark. Tom Gillesberg was running for parliament, and we had posters saying after the financial crash, we miss a Maglev train over the Kattegat, which is very provocative, because everybody was asking which crash, what kind of crash are you talking about? And we have been giving out campaign newspapers, 50,000 each time. So we have distributed around 350,000 newspapers until now, and we still have a lot of ammunitions left to mobilize with. But based on our campaign, the last election campaign was the crash, and the election, the municipality election for around 4 years ago, mm-hmm. where we had actually a campaign for a new Bretton Woods system on the posters already at that time. We had a poster which was saying when the bubble bursts, dot, 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 a new Bretton Woods. And then we had the picture of Tom, the candidate, and we had the bubble with written derivatives inside, inflation, and the real estate bubble. And this created a discussion about what is a Bretton Woods system, because just at that time nobody was talking about it, and what are derivatives. And we have journalists calling in and say, how can you have something on your posters which people don't understand? And actually we got an award for having the worst election campaign poster ever. Even the head of the city museum came by to pick up a poster to have it as a souvenir. But
now this poster is a news item, right?
So totally. I mean, when Gordon Brown just began talking using the Bretton Woods system, we got immediately a call from actually press. We had the student radio making an interview with Tom around 25 minutes. We had one of the biggest radio stations making an interview with Tom for about 6 minutes. And just a few weeks ago, the biggest Danish TV station, it's like CNN, but it's the Danish, the TV2 News, called in to ask Tom for an interview on the question of the crash and the Bretton Woods system. Because now suddenly they say, you were talking about it and you have the credit for this. So what is it? What do you know, what we don't know? And this is very, very exciting, because this is the first question Tom was asked at this radio station, which was rebroadcasted the whole night through. How could you know? Well, then Tom could go through, because I know, because I'm working with the leading economist Lyndon LaRouche, who has been prognosing this economic crash for so long time. And so this opened up the discussion of what is at stake, and is this conference going to lead somewhere?
And we should point out that subsequently, this exact kind of coverage then occurred with Lyndon LaRouche himself in Russia,
yes.
over and over and over and over again on the Russian television, with Lynn in India, on the Indian national television, with Jacques Cheminade in France on the major television and radio networks, in Italy with the finance minister of Italy adopting the LaRouche New Bretton Woods as the sole intervention by Italy anyway into this conference.
Just maybe one more note is because I called Copenhagen just before I came on the radio show, and one very exciting development is that we have politicians writing us letters back. I mean, we have one senior politician.
You mean right now? Well,
right now,
just going on.
Just today, we got a letter from one senior politician who said, "I have received a literature on the Bretton Woods. I am following very closely what you are saying about it, because you are right on this issue, and my concern is the third world. That this, how you take it up, the question of how." Do we solve this problem where the third world is included in the solution?
Okay, so I want to bring in Miles and the LaRouche Youth Movement and some of the videotapes, the DVDs and videotapes on the LaRouche PAC site that the LaRouche Youth Movement has made, because when we're talking about this now, the actual outlook and action of Franklin Delano Roosevelt towards the entire post-war period. And as LaRouche has described many times, that outlook, that action that Roosevelt intended to take in 1944 at Bretton Woods, launching the Bretton Woods system, was sabotaged by Harry Truman, and by 1971 the whole structure was abandoned, the whole idea was abandoned, with the collapse of the Bretton Woods system by Nixon and Connally and George Shultz, those who were behind them. So this has become a history of a policy and an opportunity to really develop the infrastructure of the whole world, which was missed. And it's a history that most Americans generally don't think about, don't internalize to themselves and think about the importance of it. But in the LaRouche Youth Movement in the recent 6-8 months, this history has been brought alive in a series of very pungent videotapes made by the LaRouche Movement and posted on the website. One of them, 1932, placing Roosevelt in the center of the American system of economics and how it worked. One of them, the fall of the wall, about the opportunity of 1989 and its relationship to Roosevelt's view of his outlook for the post-war world. So, Miles, this I know that you're using these videotapes out in the organizing. We all are, but that you're using them extremely intensively in organizing youth, organizing on campuses. What is the impact of this, and what's the reaction to bringing this up?
Well, I mean, they're very useful tools to get the population to actually reflect on what has caused the conditions which they're living through. Because I think one of the things that they're explicitly blocked on is, when you look at something like what Roosevelt did, the question of a historical opportunity and the way in which a certain series of events which are unfolding as a result of, in the current case, failed policies, provide an opportunity for a qualitative upshift. And Roosevelt is a great example of that, because he individually and uniquely, because there was a fascist movement inside the United States at the time of the Depression to push this corporativist fascism that was going all throughout Europe into the United States of America, to educate the population on how the personality of Franklin Roosevelt managed to organize a complete reversal, a qualitative upshift in the way that the United States was functioning, and as a result, the way that the world was functioning. And this gets at the other block, which you touched on, in the population, which is a certain sense of littleness, which is that, well, you know, maybe this opportunity is here. Maybe the situation is really bad. LaRouche is saying that we're going into a dark age, but I really can't do anything. And the value of the video product is very quickly and sensuously to give people a sense of what the historical process is, but more importantly, the fact that they're getting an immediate introduction to LaRouche, to Lyndon LaRouche, who is similar to Roosevelt, a creative personality who is personally intervening to shape the political process. And people don't really get that with any other political movement today. Franklin Roosevelt was the president of the United States. In a sense, the United States population was his political movement that he was mobilizing. Whereas today, because of the corruption in the which we have to make a real breakthrough on, in the political establishments, it's really LaRouche on the streets, which is the only individual personality which people have access to give them a sense of what a littleness of mind is not, what a real creative identity is, and how an individual is making and shaping history. And that's what we're offering people to participate in. I mean, that's what the video product, in a sense, is. It's an introduction to a creative and historical individual.
And has there been a reaction among students, for example, that you've been organizing to the potential involved here that John was talking about earlier, what this summit today should have been, could have been?
Yeah, absolutely. The universities have had an interesting reaction to us. For example, the professors have been giving us here in Boston access to the first few minutes of their lectures, such that we could brief the entire student campus body or the lecture hall on the reality of this opportunity. And we, you know, similarly, we've also had some inroads as far as getting campus clubs set up and events on campus. And following that has been an apparatus trying to shut us down and trying to keep us out, trying to keep the universities insular and ahistoric and completely focused on the bubble of the institution. So our ability to break that is kind of twofold, and it's causing us you know, some nice creative challenges in trying to figure out how to organize the institution itself. Because the attacks that we're getting as a result of some of our work only indicates that we're being somewhat successful in what we're doing. So as this situation comes to a head and as it becomes more and more apparent that the entire economy, the entire productive economy, is breaking down around the world, that you need new ideas in order to solve that crisis, and universities are institutions of ideas. And Boston is really the epicenter of that in the United States. And I mean, that represents our opportunity. We can really use that negative reaction to force these guys to change, to reflect on their assumptions and change.
Yeah, and I guess their prospects for any kind of productive or even not so productive employment are kind of vanishing in front of their eyes.
Well, in the United States, yeah. But then look at what's happening in China. You know, this is a really shocking development, which LaRouche called, because people were saying, oh, if this financial crash happens, China's going to be the next world superpower.
Uh-huh.
But as a result of this, their whole physically productive economy is crumbling before their eyes.
Yeah, this is a real, I mean, we're not going into this today, but in the current issue of Executive Intelligence Review, there is a long article by Mary Birdman, which really full of the shocking details of the sudden collapse of the so-called growth engine of the Chinese economy in September and October to a condition all of a sudden of negative growth, which no one could possibly, quote unquote, no one could possibly have anticipated, except that Lyndon LaRouche said it was going to happen, as in many of these cases. Farida, also, you have been involved in recruiting an awful lot of youth.
Yes.
In Denmark into the LaRouche youth movement.
Yes.
In Europe as a whole. How are they reacting? And, I mean, why is this happening? And is Denmark crashing into the kind of economic collapse that we see here?
We are in the beginning of it.
Only in the beginning?
Yeah, because in Denmark it's a very... it's a very mixed situation because at one side you have still 80% of the income brackets, which are these middle class, and 20%, some of them maybe very rich, some of them poor, but you have still a very a good functioning society as a whole. But the real estate bubble is going down, and the healthcare system is falling apart, and so on. But what we can see in Denmark, which is very exciting, is there's a big openness. Young people actually are quite hungry after ideas, I guess. Because, you know, in Denmark, one of the most shocking things for me is coming to Denmark is that the suicide rate in Denmark is very big. Because, you know, if you have a society which functions very well, and young people don't have a mission to go with, or you know, they don't have something out of... something they can reach after, yeah? Because young people generally are, most of them, open for doing something for mankind, because it's not enough just to exist for yourself. So we are seeing a big openness in the youth. Most of them are there in Germany. We have one in the US, actually Miles knows this person very well, and we have one in Sweden, they are in Berlin, in Dresden, in Essen. And the potential of recruitment, especially in these times like right now, is very, very big. We have been distributing the newspapers at the universities. We are getting regularly, actually, emails. We are having people who are sending money in. It's also young people, actually, not older people, but young people who are really eager to say, we have to, you know, to make sure that we exist in Denmark.
And also, what we hear here is that the parliament is wide open to you, and you're repeatedly testifying in the parliament. The Schiller Institute's being invited in there.
Yeah,
and this is happening elsewhere in Europe, also everywhere outside Germany, really, where we are.
We have been testifying this year, only this year, already three times. In the beginning of the year on the financial crash, which was to the Political Economic Committee, which was very, very, they were very reserved. Then we had on the nuclear energy, the importance of nuclear energy, and on the financial crash again, on the new Bretton Woods system, which this time was in the middle of the crash. And after Tom gave the testimony, which we also put out on the internet in English as well, there were no questions. And then they were saying to us, actually, the head of this committee, there is no questions because we all know very well your analysis about this crash. So.
Okay, so John, back onto the crash. You're still with us?
Yeah.
There's a lot of garbled discussion all of a sudden in the last month in the various press about the subject of financial derivatives, which they seem to have discovered about a month ago. You've been writing about it and testifying in Congress, which is what brought this back to my mind, for some 15 years now. This threat of derivatives. What's the issue there? What's the action that was required there in terms of this summit? Again, I ask you, what should they have done? And what is the real impact of the derivatives bubble in this breakdown collapse?
Well, you've got a derivatives bubble that is in the well over $250 billion in size. You know, nobody really knows how big it is. But if you look at the whole thing, it's probably, you know, several quadrillion dollars in size.
And no one's discovered how big a quadrillion is.
Yeah, yeah. They're beginning to figure it out now that they're trying to cash out.
And that it's really worth something very small.
Yes, yes. And so you have this, when the financial system shut down last year, you have it's sort of like the heart of the body stopping, and then you have the various organs shutting down. You now have the derivatives market, which is crashing, as everybody is combination of people who are trying to get out to turn what they have left of this funny money that they used to play in the derivatives market into real dollars to try to bring that money that they had in this off-balance sheet world back into the real economy. And there's not enough to go around. And they're also being hit with enormous losses as this thing unwinds. And so there's enormous selling pressure, which is what's causing the stock market to go down all the time, that everybody's trying to sell in order to meet margin calls, because this is a classic, you know, reverse leverage blowout. Now, the only way to stop a thing like this is to simply stop it, to say, okay, fine.
Let me just interrupt you for a minute on that. I should have asked you earlier, but when you testified, I forget if it was 93 or 94, to the U.S. Congress Henry Gonzalez's committee on banning derivatives, what was the size of the derivatives, nominal size of the derivatives bubble then?
It was, I think, around $12 trillion.
And now it's several quadrillion.
Yes.
In that range, nominally.
Nominally.
But disappearing quickly.
Yes.
All right, so that gives an idea of what you were warning of in 1993, 1994. Go ahead with what you were saying. The thing to do is to stop it.
The thing to do is to stop it, which is you just, since it's all speculative bets, there's no real economic activity which goes on in the derivatives market. There's no real economic activity which depends upon the derivatives market. The way to approach this is to just basically declare derivatives null and void. You know, they're the equivalent of gambling bets that are illegal, that there are no settlements on derivatives issues because the derivatives no longer exist.
Freeze them.
You freeze them. Actually, what you do is you can just ban, you just declare all contracts null and void, and so therefore the whole subject is settled. Mm-hmm. It may not make the people who are speculators very happy, but from the standpoint of reorganizing the economic system, you've just settled the derivatives issue because they no longer exist. And people who had claims coming, they're just out of luck. Because you're going to freeze, then you take what's left and you freeze it. And then you begin the workout process. But there's no way that you can actually ever settle all of these derivatives contracts. Because the whole purpose of derivatives was to cover up for the fact that the world was operating below break-even and taking on enormous amounts of debt. And so the financial system was making all of its money through speculation on virtual assets and claiming those the profits that what they called profits from transactions in virtual assets to be real profits. And, you know, we don't have enough economic activity in the world to begin to cover all of that. So we just have to get rid of it.
And this was, how would I put it, brought up in at least a glancing way by several heads of state before the summit, a month before the summit, Sarkozy of France, Aso of Japan, perhaps one or two others, referred to this enormous offshore, and as you said, off balance sheet, humongous bubble of debt, and doing something about it. So it brings us to the question, which I'll perhaps stay with you. What is actually happening instead at this summit? What are they doing?
Well, the summit was... The first thing is that Bush doesn't really want anything to change. Bush is more concerned with making his escape. So you have the Bush administration announcing all of these various bailout plans that they actually know won't work. But what they think they'll do, what they hope they can do, is buy time. Buy time to get through the inauguration and then, you know, dump the whole thing on the incoming administration and let them deal with it. And, you know, that's pretty irresponsible and pretty sleazy, but then that's the Bush administration. And then you have the other major player in this is Gordon Brown, who's trying to use, as I said before, to try to use this crisis to create this global financial dictatorship, to put the last nail in the coffin of the nation state so that the empire doesn't have to deal with that anymore and they can run the world through their cartels. And then there are others who are coming in who are looking seriously for some sort of solution. Now, they may not be ready to adopt the solution that we're proposing, but they know that what's going on is not working and they're looking for some sort of way out. Maybe they want to compromise. You know, you had Sarkozy of France who's calling for some sorts of global regulation. But, you know, none of that stuff will work. There was nothing that was discussed. We don't have all the transcripts or anything yet, but there's nothing that was discussed at this meeting which is in the realm of an actual solution that would be seriously taken up. Because they are ruling out dealing with this crisis by putting the global system through bankruptcy and shutting down this monetary system. And if you're not going to do that, then it really doesn't matter what you do.
Frieda, did you want to add to that?
Oh, no.
No, okay.
This is maybe just one thing. I mean, yeah. On the way here from Denmark to the U.S., there was some funny article about this meeting because, you know, they were saying there's nothing going to come out of this meeting, nothing at all, you know, not a bit, because it's going to be a macho show. You know, Sarkozy is going to show off and he's going to play his ego play, and the worst thing is going to be Gordon Brown, who's going to be an even bigger ego trip he's going to have, because he's just playing up like he's the world finance minister. So therefore, this meeting is not going to lead anywhere.
Well, it's going to lead directly. I should say that Lyndon LaRouche already has commented on this meeting as it was about to occur, that it was a complete avoidance of the action that has to be taken. It is shaped up as a disaster because these heads of state have got together and they've decided not to do the one thing that has to be done, the thing that John went through at the outset, replacing this system with an actual new Bretton Woods system, with fixed currency exchanges, with major infrastructure cross country and multi-country infrastructure credit for great projects. They are avoiding this issue entirely. LaRouche said it was going to be worse than no meeting at all, a disaster. He, on Tuesday of this week, this past week, already had issued, had a private meeting with a number of very important people from a number of the countries, the United States, European and South American countries, which are going to be participating, or whose heads of state were going to be participating. For that private meeting, he issued a declaration, whereas the international monetary system is dead, and in that declaration laid out what had to be done. Now he's going to follow that this Tuesday, the 18th of November at 1 o'clock in the afternoon, with an international meeting, which will be internationally webcast. It will be webcast in a number of congressional settings in quite a number of countries, and also other more informal union and campus and other places all over the world. And that webcast will be in just 3 days from now, and there LaRouche will sketch out the consequences of what's happened and what has to be done. So that's at 1 o'clock on this coming Tuesday, the 18th. It's on www.laRouchePAC.com and also www.laRouchePub.com. Both websites will be broadcasting that webcast beginning at 1. So that leads to the question that I could just throw out to any of you or to all of us. If, as it looks, these heads of state have met and effectively done nothing, what's going to be the result of that? What's going to happen as a result of that?
Well, what we will see is we will see an escalation of this, the collapse of the financial system. The speed at which this has been occurring, you know, if you look at, say, back in December, you had these first bailouts, and they said that, you know, $40 billion, this is going to solve everything. And then you had another crisis erupt in March, around the end of the quarter. And then you had a worse crisis yet erupt in September, around the end of the quarter, in which, you know, you lost, you had Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac bailed out. You had the collapse of Lehman Brothers. You know, you had all this carnage in the market. And now we're headed into a period where things are going to collapse even further, because you're in a death spiral. The more you have to sell, and everybody has to sell to meet their margin requirements to cover the debts that they incurred for their speculation. This whole thing is going down the tubes. It's like you're circling the toilet, and as you get closer and closer to the center, you keep going faster and faster. And there's no way to pull out of this. That this is just going to get worse. And that's the one thing that we have going for us, in a sense, which is that all of the people who are standing on the sidelines saying, well, you may be right, but I don't want to believe it, are going to be forced to come to grips with the fact that in fact it is getting worse, that nothing has been done that will solve the problem. And sooner or later, they're either going to have to get serious, or they're going to see consequences they never dreamed of.
I guess also, I think the biggest problem is going to be, like one French newspaper was saying, that if nothing comes out of this weekend, we can expect chaos on the streets of the U.S. In terms of, you know, the expectations were not fulfilled to act in the interest of the normal people. But I guess one thing which is quite important is that the system is collapsing, and the people like Gordon Brown and Paulson, and they want to keep the system alive for the oligarchy, for the financial interests, for the hedge funds, for the banks, for the system. They want to keep the system alive for the system's sake. And the danger is actually war. The danger is destabilization. The danger is to put something, to trigger something so that you get chaos. And Lyndon LaRouche was talking about this threat that Obama could be killed. before he gets to be put into the White House. I guess this is very important that people, you know, that there's awareness that this threat is actually there. Even in Europe, in the Danish press, they were talking about the threat of assassination. But I mean, the biggest problem in this period of time, like now, is when the system is crashing and the oligarchy wants to keep the control by chaos and destabilization. And therefore, this keep the eye on the go and say, okay, the enemy wants to destabilize the U.S., by maybe getting rid of Obama and then creating chaos, and everybody lose their heads and nobody controls what comes out of it.
But in that French newspaper's comment is the assumption it's worse in the United States than it is in Europe. What about that? I know that Lyndon LaRouche has said the opposite. Helga LaRouche has said the opposite, that Europe is in worse condition because of its incapacity, its parliamentary incapacity to do anything about this.
I mean, I'm very excited to be in the U.S. and to get like this finger on the pulse. Because one thing is, we have been wondering also in Denmark of, okay, what is Lynn meaning about? What does he mean with that? It is worse in Europe than in the U.S. because if seemingly it doesn't, it is not worse in terms of poverty and unemployment and so on, but in terms of inaction. I mean, it's the Social Democrats who in the 30s put into the Hjalmar Schacht policy.
Hjalmar Schacht, the finance minister of Hitler.
Yeah. And it is right now the Social Democrats, for example, in Denmark, who wants to privatize everything, and they don't defend the social state.
And Miles, in what you were saying about China earlier, the same point is made that you know, there is a false discussion of this around the world as if it were a problem in the United States, in which the United States was going into a depression and others were being affected, rather than looking at this system as a whole from the way that John started with it.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, the question of money permeates the discussion of this economic crisis, just like the question of money permeates any discussion of economic developments or anything like this today in economic classes. So now the focus is going to have to be on the physical collapse, because that is the most evident and the most dangerous element of the financial blowout. So, I mean, the population is going to have to confront this axiom that money is the basis of economics. Mm-hmm. And then either accept Hjalmar Schacht as a global alternative to this blowout, or scrap it and work on figuring out LaRouche's physical economic conceptions. And unless that happens, we're going into a dark age.
When you say Hjalmar Schacht, that's what you mean, right? A dark age. The dark age for the working people and others of Germany.
Right.
That he imposed on them as Hitler's finance minister.
I have a question on that, though, because LaRouche is saying that the way you would counter that is with this four-power agreement with other nations, specifically Russia, the United States, China, and India, and other nations participating in on that. And his focus for the United States is organizing the institution of the presidency.
Mm-hmm.
There's some unclarity in the population as to what that institution is, especially with all this hype along the lines of what Obama was able to do with his campaign. But maybe you could develop on that question.
John, do you want to?
Yeah, I think the institution of the presidency, what Lynn has been stressing about this is that there is an institution which is based around the concept of having a president of the United States, a strong executive, which goes far beyond the person in the office or even his immediate circle of office holders, which is sort of the core of the difference between, say, our system and the parliamentary system. In the parliamentary system, especially, you know, taking the case of Britain, where you have a parliament which is basically a sideshow, and you have a prime minister, who's basically a flunky. And the power is vested in the Privy Council, which actually is the ruling body of Britain. And they're controlled by this financial oligarchy.
Mm-hmm.
So you really don't have a government as such in terms of you know, by the people, for the people. What you have is an oligarchic system which rules the people with the illusion that you have some sort of a democracy, but that you really don't. Now, in our system, because you have the, you know, the three branches of government, you have a balance of power among them, but it is the executive which acts, and the executive is acting on behalf of, at least in theory, on behalf of the people. So whenever you have a crisis in this country, what you tend to have is you have people who are involved in the various aspects of this institution of the presidency who then are called upon, who were intervened to help provide a continuity of government and a continuity of policy, you know, to sort of, if you get a president like we have now, which, you know, is out of control, that you could have these saner elements come in and try to contain the damage. And I think so there's sort of this historical connection, and there's this, that, you know, like Lyndon LaRouche is part of this institution of the presidency, because historically we've had a lot of connections with people in the government, a lot of role in shaping policy, such as in the FDI and in certain security and anti-drug policies and foreign policies and things like that. And that's a concept which really doesn't exist in the European government. And it doesn't always work here, but it's far better than the alternative. I don't know if that helps answer your question or not.
Well, I could throw in something more positive definitely positive example of this, which was the first president and his first Treasury Secretary, because clearly what Hamilton did, and LaRouche is constantly referring to this in regard to his memo on what had to be done, what should have been done by this summit, and what has not been done. He's constantly been referring to the Hamiltonian basis of creating a new monetary system. There was a situation in which it was the classic example of the replacement of money debt, which was floating around in every variety and every unpayable form during the Confederacy of the period of the Confederation. The replacement of all that money debt under Hamilton's Treasury by credit, by newly issued credit, which was directed into the development of the infrastructure and the manufacturers and the productivity of the country, and therefore was able to replace that unpayable debt with very repayable, very productive credit. Now, Hamilton did this with a president who himself did not understand that method of credit. He was obviously a great president, and he certainly was totally supportive of Hamilton, but he himself was not a master of what Hamilton did. Hamilton did it, and very rapidly the Treasury Department became virtually the entire government, at least in the first administration of George Washington. And as it did that, it made the presidency itself, that is Hamilton's actions, made the presidency itself far stronger in a situation where at first many people, Jefferson and others, many people thought that the president would be an appendage of the Congress and would give it a report every year, and that would be mainly his duties. Hamilton completely changed that situation by what he did. And furthermore, Washington would not have picked him to be Treasury Secretary unless people around Washington who were part of that institution of the very first presidency said to him, the person you have who is most capable of taking on this incredible task is Alexander Hamilton. When Washington first heard that, he said, but I don't think he knows anything about finance. And he was instructed differently. And he made Hamilton, Treasury Secretary. That kind of situation can occur, and LaRouche's point, I think, is that it has repeatedly developed as the institution of the presidency, both for our exceptional good presidents and for the many mediocre and really bad presidents that we've had, some of whom bordering on treasonous presidents before the Civil War and so forth. That institution has pulled through. So anyway, that's...
And this thing that provoked me with what LaRouche said in this last webcast was that the institution of the presidency exists across generations, and it changes with the ideas of individuals who have long since died, mm-hmm. and that it really is an immortal institution that develops certain conceptions through people's lifetimes and through people's personalities.
So there in Boston, what are the what's the organizing going on for the webcast up there or around the webcast? How do you think you'll be fielding the consequences of this summit this week?
Well, I mean, it's pretty explosive. All eyes at this point are on Monday. The European press has said that this failure of this conference is going to precede a dramatic crash in the markets. But that really doesn't change anything. I mean, LaRouche is intervening on Tuesday on the collapse of the entire financial system, and our organizing with these universities has been generally in that vein. So we've got an event set up at one university. Another event just fell through at another university. And we're going to just keep escalating and changing our approach as we go with these institutions, because we're really looking at the university system in Boston especially as part of the institution of the presidency. So we're going to try to find the best and most willing individuals in these places, professors, students, faculty alike, and use them as our allies to really promote sanity.
And by that, you obviously don't mean Gordon Brown's College of Regulators. You mean colleges of potential thinkers. Farida, go ahead.
Maybe just one note is that the LaRouche Youth Movement has made this short film on the American presidency, which is really worth seeing. So everybody, any listener who has been listening to this show, should go and see this.
And that means
short film.
And that means, again, go on www.larouchepac.com, and it's impossible to miss the outlay of the videos on that site, because they are what the LaRouche PAC and the LaRouche Youth Movement are using in order to really move people to take this situation in their hands. So further on this, Miles, you brought up China. How does this either you or John or any of us, this is something that many people's eyes are on, the sudden collapse of the Chinese growth machine, so-called, and its connection to the American economy. What's going to happen with that?
John?
Yeah. Well, I think that as the U.S. economy shuts down, then our exports, our imports from China are going to shut down. And so, and China basically has become an outsourcing center for the United States and Europe to handle production that we no longer do here. Mm-hmm. And as that collapses, then the Chinese economy will collapse, because it never became a full set economy in the way that it needs to. It never developed its own internal markets in the way that it really needs to do in order to function without being an adjunct of the United States and Europe. And, you know, world trade is shutting down, and that's an ominous trend for everyone in the world.
Maybe also this, that there was a speculation in the raw materials, which is a big problem in aluminium and so on, which has a big effect on the economy as well, because a lot of mining is suffering under it. And
And this is now sometimes being called deflation. John, is it?
well, there is a certainly a savage deflation going on in the financial world as this derivatives market unwinds, as the asset values, the fictitious values of the collateralized debt obligations and all of this sort of nonsense just disappear. Then there's a tremendous deflation in the financial world. And what you're seeing in terms of these commodity prices and things like that is the extent to which speculation was keeping them artificially high. And now you remove that speculation as it dies, and prices collapse. So there is a combination in the financial world, especially, of a deflation which is being countered by central bank money pumping. So you have the deflation is the hole is growing. They're attempting to fill that hole by pouring money into it, which gives you the worst of both worlds. You have a deflation of a financial system at which, at the same time, you have a hyperinflation of the value of your dollar. And basically, it's a scorched earth policy. Everything gets wiped out when it really gets going.
You want to just give us an idea of how much has been pumped, how much money has been printed and pumped in?
Well, the Bank of England itself said last month that it was $7 trillion. The central banks have pumped in $7 trillion in loans, in guarantees, and things like that. That in the United States, it's probably around $5 trillion. And these programs are growing like weeds. It seems like they're adding a new bailout facility virtually every week. And so it's a hyperbolic growth rate. If you look at it since they started this process back in December, and it's sort of like a plane, a fighter plane taking off from a runway, and it goes straight for a while, and then it slowly climbs into the air, and then once it reaches enough of an altitude, it kicks in and just starts to go straight up. And that's the process that we're heading into. We've lifted off the runway, and we're beginning to make that turn.
Maybe also this crisis, I mean, reflects this question of what the US, the role of the US, because now, I mean, if we get a new financial system and or not, it's going to depend mostly if the US goes along, if we can get the ideas of the American Revolution back into the institutions or into the presidency with our campaign, and the hopes of the mankind is lying on the US. I as a European, I'm here, and I can really just encourage that you see what we're going to achieve in the US. It's going to decide the destiny of mankind, and therefore the eyes of mankind is on the US.
And on the institution of the presidency of the United States, in the way that we've been discussing it, when I was talking about reality at the beginning, that reality is directly connected to the LaRouche factor in all of this and to the potential of that institution of the presidency. So that although we have seen no action suitable to the problem, really worse than that, no action at all thus far, and the Bush White House playing a role in blocking any serious action at this summit, nonetheless, there's a dramatic situation in which that is being changed by the breakdown crisis itself, by what Miles and John and Farida have been discussing here. This breakdown crisis is not something that's going to last a year and then go into a recovery cycle or any of this nonsense. From whom is the United States going to continue to borrow multiple trillions of dollars every year or every 6 months of its debt? That process is leading to a breakdown crisis, one in which the presidential institution will simply have to act. Now, we'll close by reminding you again that Tuesday at 1 o'clock on these websites, LaRouche Pub and LaRouche Pack, Lyndon LaRouche will make this crystal clear in an international webcast, which you really just have got to watch and get people together with you in order to watch, as they'll be doing it at campuses and in congresses and in many places around the world. So with that, Let me thank John Hopeful and Farida Gillisberg and Miles Robinson and wind up this LaRouche show for November 15th, 2008.